Okay, it's working now.
So I'll sit and speak. I think that's more comfortable for me. Okay, so thank you. I would just like to, first of all, thank Professor Jan Westerhoff. He has known me for now almost a year, and I have a very interesting and important connection with him. So I finished my PhD last year from University of Delhi, and he was my one of my external examiners, and so I was very fortunate to have a very kind of a candid and as well as a very interesting and an important feedback from him regarding my thesis. It helped me to improve it further. So this presentation basically is from my dissertation. What I worked on my dissertation was a very lesser known school of thought that existed at the time of, Buddha. And this school perhaps it's just not one school, but there were many schools in ancient Indian period of around 6th-7th century BC. That's around, some 2600 years back. And the school was one of the, sects that existed. I worked for around 6 years to basically get something out of it so that it could look something concrete and, relevant. And finally, for around 3.5 years or so, I worked officially on my thesis and finished it. So it's been almost a 7-8 year affair that I'm having with this area of research. Anyhow, so the topic, as you can see, is called the suspension of judgment in ancient Indian agnosticism. So the period that I'm referring, as I said, is around the time when Buddha lived, and that time is, if you see, is basically the late Iron Age, as we describe it. And at that time in India, there was a kind of a boon for various historical and economical reasons. There was a lot of development in various fields of knowledge, whether it was trade, science, philosophy, and so on and so forth. And among them, there was a whole section of society that started to ponder and dwell into into certain metaphysical questions, philosophical questions. And we find that in Indian history around that time, there are too many sects and movements that came up, which were trying to know about nature of reality and man's position within it, as to if whatever is the reality, where do we are there, and how does that benefit us if we know about all that. So all these questions were discussed around that time. And one of the two traditions that survived and are still there amongst so many of them that existed at that time is Jainism and Buddhism, which finally, of course, survived and have become into prominent religions. So, these sects that existed, these were mainly, you can call them ascetics, mendicants, monks, recluse, and these were known as in Sanskrit or Pali as shamana or shramana, shramanas. Basically, these were literally shramana means the one who labors in search of truth, and these were the people who were basically not living life like lay people, but they were wandering from place to place, and focused mainly on understanding the self or the world, and to know if there is any reality, what sort of it is. And they basically were debating and questioning about the nature of the soul, what if there is anything real, if at all yes, what sort of nature it has, and also they were talking about that can we even know anything or not in the first place. So all sorts of philosophical and metaphysical questions were discussed. Then moving on to the sect that I'm working, it's basically in Sanskrit, it's called Agyana. Agyana in Sanskrit actually means ignorance. And this school, in fact, there were many sects which had this, inclination to perhaps not really give a certain definite response to such questions. So one prominent school that was there among many others is what I have worked on, and I'll talk about them. But if you see, that's how they were named. They were either called Agyan or Agyanika. This name was basically given by the rival schools, the other traditions that existed, because ignorance in Indian philosophy is generally considered to be the root of all suffering. It has a negative connotation to it. So when these schools are named as Agyana, we don't know if they themselves really called themselves as that. But that's how we know about them in more mainly in Jain and Buddhist sources to be referred as. So this sect, basically, if you see, this is how we generally describe their views. These people, when they were asked about philosophical, they were asked philosophical questions, they responded like this. They basically neither held any opinion, neither denied any opinion, nor affirm or deny any opinion at the same time, nor even admitted that they neither affirmed or denied any opinion. So it's a bit complex, maybe at the face of it, but that's how this is they are generally described as in a brief way. So these people, they question the beliefs and knowledge of all other orthodox as heterodox schools existing at that time in India. Well, orthodox basically were the ones which we know as the Brahmanas. These are just technical terms, but basically in India, ancient India, Vedic texts had a very important significance, the Vedas, which is a huge corpus of literature. So many schools of thought and many people, they were trying to read Vedas and develop their philosophy based on the Vedas. So these were the orthodox systems or thinkers, and the ones who were kind of independent from the Vedic literature were the Shramanas or the heterodox schools. So Agyan thinkers did not really rely on the Vedas for their whatever philosophy that they advocated, just like mainly like the Buddhist and the Jain philosophies as well. And the sources that we have of the Agyana school is mainly from the Buddhist and few Jain scriptures. So basically these people were not really interested in holding anything to affirm any kind of knowledge to be as certain or not certain. So agnostics did not claim that any conclusive knowledge about any of the matters debated by philosophers is possible or impossible. For purposes of argument, they developed a technique of systematic evasion, which we call it as Amar Vikshep. So Amar means endless, and Vikshep means escapism or escaping it. So endless escape approach they had. And they appear to have deprecated argument as leading to bad tempers and loss of peace of mind. Instead, they seem to have advocated friendship and it being non-rival, which is, so basically we generally understand them as someone who avoided taking positions. In fact, they rather cared more about peace of mind and being non-rival to other views, because if you don't hold a position, you're not going against anybody. So that kind of an attitude. So it was basically called aviruddhak, basically somebody who's not a rival to your thinking. They seem to have taught that the various kinds of thoughts, beliefs, or their denial were not consistent with each other, say beliefs on nature of soul, for example. Such speculation could only be confusing and harmful, or lead to harmful actions, such as disputes, or ultimately remorse and consequent obstruction to peace of mind, and they should therefore be avoided. At the time of Buddha and Mahavir, the teacher Sanjay Bilatiputta was a well-known proponent of such thinking. So among the various sects that we have found in the texts of Jain and Buddhist literature, nobody's ever mentioned, except for one man named Sanjay Bilatiputta. He was a senior contemporary to Buddha, who is specially mentioned as one of the proponent of such school. But among the extant literature in Buddhist and Jain literature, we find very scanty references of him. So moving on, in Buddhist literature you find not just Sanjay, but there are other heretical teachers as well. So to show the richness and the amount of debate that existed at that time, in that time period, we have the Buddhist and Jain literature also mentions a few other thinkers. So just to show that how, you know, so many kinds of views they were existing at that time. So and Sanjay was among one of them, but I would show that how he's so different from all others. So the first one, for example, just to give you a kind of a background, well, another popular thinker at the time of Buddha was Purana Kassapa, who basically held the theory of amoralism or non-causal theory. He believed that there's no action happening really, and everything is eternal, and there is no actions. The second one, Makhali Ghoshala, was an advocate of fatalism. That means, he belonged to the Ajivika sect. There was another sect called Ajivika sect. So these were the people who believed that humans do not have any free will, and neither do they have free will nor will. So everything is predetermined, and everything is pre-decided. So human actions are irrelevant. So no matter what you do in life, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect or changes anything. Everything is predetermined beforehand. So whatever you are, you were living like that, and you ought to live like that, or you're determined to live like that. So anyways, and then there was Pakuda Kachayana, who believed in eternalism, who believed that nothing perishes. Everything is eternal. So change is superficial, and there's no such thing as really any sort of, and annihilation is an illusion. Nothing is destroyed ever. Then lastly was, of course, the Nigantha Nataputta, which is famously known as Mahavir, the most important leader, spiritual leader in Jainism. So he advocated the theory of non-violence and Anekantvad, which is the view of many position of holding that there are many realities and so on and so forth. So basically these are just handful of thinkers brought up to give you an example that how there were so many thinkers existing, and they were trying to give some response to metaphysical questions in their own way. Moving on, now I come to Sanjay, who was basically the main thinker whom I worked upon. And so this is the original quotation or the reference that we find in the in the Brahmajal and the Samanafala Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. And here it is said that, so when Sanjay was asked questions concerning metaphysical and philosophical truths, he said that if you ask me if there exists another world after death, for example, if I thought there exists another world, would I declare that to you? I don't think so. I don't think in that way. I don't think otherwise. I don't think not. I don't think not. So, and if you asked me if there isn't another world, that means if there is no world after we die, that's the end. Both is and isn't, neither is nor isn't. If there are beings who transmigrate, that means do we have another life after death? If there aren't, both are and aren't, neither are nor aren't. If the Tathagata exists after death, that means if somebody claims to have been enlightened, if that person exists after death, does both neither exist nor doesn't exist after that? Would I declare that to you? I don't think so. I don't think in that way. I don't think otherwise. I don't think not. I don't think not. So there is a complicated response, if you see. Firstly, if you see, the questions are put into various ways, expressed in various ways, and all of them have been, escaped to be responded. So, and if you see there, the entire quotation, I have made it, systematized manner, put it into a systematized manner. And if you can see, basically what is happening here is that, so what Sanjay was doing according to the interpretation was that all the questions that were asked, he said, you can put them into a fourfold manner. So each question or each position can be expressed in a tetralemma. So suppose if I ask you, is there life after death? So if that's a position, then the second proposition would be based on Chaturshkoti or the Tetralemma will be if there is no life after death. The third would be if there is and is there no life after death. And finally, that I'm holding that there is neither is nor is not after death. So these are the four possibilities, apparently, Sanjay thought that you can, you know, elaborate a viewpoint into an affirmation, negation, both, and neither affirmation nor negation. And out of all these four positions that one would advocate, no matter what the content is, the response was fourfold, which you can see in a form of a pentalemma. Evam tipimino, tathatipimino, annathatipimino, no tipimino, no no tipimino. This is in Pali, which basically translates as, based on Thanissaro, I do not say it is this, I do not say it is that, I do not say it is otherwise, I do not say it is not, and I do not say it is not of not. So if you see, Sanjay was doing something very interesting. He developed a sophisticated method to evade any kind of response that would be expected out of various ways in which you can put a metaphysical question to him. So this is what I tried to formulate it from the quotations that I received from various sources. Moving on, if you see, I tried to study the method of what he tried to do. So we found that what he was doing was basically what we understand is as what he was probably doing was elocutions rather than, you know, expressing propositions. So, I just read, Gyan thinkers could successfully suspend all judgments without committing to any position whatsoever, even when suspension of judgment itself was taken as a belief or an ideology. This was because they made elocutions or elocutionary negations rather than propositional negations. So let's understand that. Maybe that would give a better understanding of what they were doing, really. So if you see, a propositional negation is basically where you do commit an act, or you know, you perform an act of stating something, which could be a denial. For example, I say X is not. So I hold an explicit position that X is not. But on the other hand, if you see these agnostics, these Agyan thinkers, what they were doing was they were denying the very act of affirming or denying a statement. So they said, I do not say X is. So, and I do not say X is not. So, so the very act of committing to hold anything to be or to not to be was not made in the first place. So in the first case, if you see here, that's where we come. If you see in elocutionary negation, in a propositional negation, what happens is you do end up into a contradiction because you hold that I say X is not, and if I make a propositional negation of the previous one, I get I say X is. So if I hold both, there is a contradiction because I'm saying X is not and I'm saying X is. But if I say, for example, I do not say X is, and if I say I do not say X is not, I'm not even making any sort of commitment about any affirmation or negation. So this was how perhaps they were successfully able to escape any kind of, taking any kind of position despite giving a response to questions. So in the second statement, if you see, there is no commitment made at all to any affirmation or negation, and that's absolutely fine. It's not contradictory to utter that. So this, and if you see the structure of the utterances, it is translated as I do not say. So, and there is one objection perhaps that can be raised is that elocutions perhaps is a very modern way of understanding a language, and you know, these people were speaking thousands of years before. How can we actually think that elocutions were the ones that they were really working with? Because elocutions are something that we understand today in philosophy of language. There's a lot of discussion and debates and study happening in elocutions today in modern philosophy of language. Well, to answer, because it seems anachronistic maybe at one level to think like that we are saying that they were performing elocutions. Who knows what they were doing at that time? So to answer that kind of objection, I would say that in Buddhist texts also in Majjhima Nikaya we do find Buddha also saying certain questions to be responded in this way. And so we do see various, sects also uttering similar kinds of utterances and giving them. So we do not believe that, and they have been interpreted as elocutions as well. So we do believe that this is not something that is artificially projected on to this school, but they did actually had such kind of a method, unfortunately, which was not described in a great detail in the sources where they are listed. So this is how it is. So if you see, very technically, logically, they escaped the very act of, caught into taking any position. So if you see further, so I worked a lot in the method. I do not have that much of time to explore the method in their detail, that response to fivefold response to those four set of questions. So what happened was in one of the Buddhist texts, Sumarangal Vilasini by Buddha Ghosh, there was a Buddhist scholar in 5th century AD who, of course, wrote commentaries on Buddhist texts. And since Sanjay was also mentioned in the Buddhist scriptures, he was also commented upon. So Buddha Ghosh tried to interpret the method of Sanjay. He is one of the first persons, I think, as far as my understanding and knowledge goes, who tried to interpret Sanjay's meaning of thought. And he took him more seriously than other commentators. And he tried to express down what perhaps he could have meant. And further, of course, modern scholars also worked on this idea and interpreted it. So based on my personal research, along with that of the interpretation of Buddha Ghosh and contemporary scholarship, this is how we found that perhaps this is the way in which the dialectical method used by Sanjay was expressed. So if you see the first, if you see carefully, to each question that was asked in a tetralemma, there was a fivefold response. So that actually makes the whole response to be 20-fold, because to first lemma you find a fivefold response, to the second, which is a negation, you find a fivefold response, to the third you find a fivefold response, and to the fourth again you find a fivefold response. So it actually expands up to 20 statements. So when we were trying to understand and decipher this apparently complicated methodology, we found that perhaps this is how it can be interpreted. So the first utterance, when he said, "I do not think this is," was perhaps interpreted as, suppose if somebody asked in philosophical, in philosophy or in knowledge, that if there is something real but is not expressed ever, so there are philosophical positions where people may have experienced something but will be quiet about it for their whole life, never speak about it, never even utter that they cannot express it, but keep silent about it. Maybe certain mystics and quietics. So that kind of a position is not, of course, admitted by or not, held by Sanjay. Then the second position possibly could be where some people believe that, okay, there is something real, but we can't describe it. So they state that there is some truth, but we can't describe it. It's indescribable. I have given an example from an Indian philosophical school. So some sort of anirvachaniya is a concept in another Indian philosophy school, which holds that there is an absolute reality, but you can't describe affirmatively about it. So that's not the position we hold or we adhere to. We do not say we are like this, these people. Then third is negation, or the alternate version of the position of the above position, the number two position. Okay, that you don't believe in indescribability of one kind of a school, but maybe another kind of indescribability, like the way in Jain thought we have another concept of indescribability called avyaktavya. No. We're not holding that view. Then the fourth is, okay, fine. So you're not holding above three. So maybe you hold the fourth, that is, something is real and describable. And you hold a philosophical position and you think you can talk about it, discuss and put it into language and name and form. That's not what we commit or we hold. Then the fifth is, okay, perhaps you are holding a negation of the above position. So basically, you are not holding the real indescribable of this kind, eternalism, say for example, but you perhaps hold the opposite view of describability, maybe you don't hold describability of A, suppose if I hold eternalism, maybe you believe in accidentalism or fatalism or another kind of describable theory, because you can have various described theories in philosophy and knowledge. That's also not we claim. Then the sixth is, so then perhaps you have the another version of the fourth position. That means you believe in describing a truth, but you don't hold, say for example, eternalism of Pakuda Kachayana, but eternalism of Parmenides, maybe some another thinker. So you do, so an alternate version of some describability. So not different, but an alternate version. That's also not the thing they want to hold. Then the next is, okay, you want to contradict. So you believe that you don't hold describable position, so you basically think that you believe in the negation of describability. So maybe annihilational theory, a contradictory position to eternalism, that's also we don't hold. So we skip basically to commit to that position. So since nothing of the above, no describability, no indescribability, no alternate versions, no way, different kinds of views are accepted. So you are basically taking the position of neither, neither this nor that, none of the above. That's not what we hold again. Then we go also, then nothing of the above is also held. That means you are accepting both negation as well as not negation. Because if I'm saying I don't accept neither this nor that, it seems as if maybe you're accepting something then. That's also not what we hold. And finally, if you since nothing of the above is again claimed from all that was said, the position is eventually we don't want to hold anything no matter what. Neither none of the above. So, fine. Since you are escaping to take a position on any of the positions, including none of the above, so your position is we don't hold none of the above. They say, no, we don't even hold that. So that's how they keep on escaping to, they keep trying to escape from getting caught into a position. And in Buddhist literature, they are therefore called as eel wrigglers, So Buddhists, they call it eel wrigglers, and they're interpreted as people who... So Buddha warns his disciple not to talk to disciples of Sanjay and Agyana thinkers much, because they will talk to you, but you wouldn't get anything out of that. They are like a slippery fish. Their talk is like a slippery fish. So you hold the fish, but if you try to squeeze it a bit, it slips out of your hand. So they're speaking a lot, and you think you can like actually understand them. But when you try to focus in detail, you don't get anything. So they are mocked by the Buddhists, early Buddhists that stay away from them, whether they look amicable or whether they look opposite to what you like, still stay away from them. The Jain thinkers call them double-blinded because they think that the followers or the seekers and disciples are blind because they don't know the truth, they're ignorant. And the leaders and the spiritual teachers give you the truth. But here, the disciples are blind and the teachers are also blind. So because they don't claim any truths at all. So therefore, there is a double blinding, and that's worse. So there's a lot of criticism among many other sects and schools of thought who are criticizing them. So if you see, there is a whole effort to overcome or kind of escape any kind of conceivable position conceptually by this school of thought. So if you see, Nagarjuna, a very important Buddhist thinker, though we don't have this text in Sanskrit, but it was later translated into Chinese, Mahapragya Paramita Shastra, it's just an important reference that Nagarjuna also takes it up. What happens is that in the history of Buddhist literature, it is claimed that two most important disciples of Buddha, which is Upatissa and Kalita, they were firstly the students of Sanjay, and later they left his tutelage and went on to Buddha. So there is a conversation in Mahapragya Paramita Shastra, and of course in Mahavagga, there are some certain texts in Buddhism where there's a debate, and there. So the Upatissa and Kalita, who were basically disciples and pupils of Sanjay, the Jnana thinker, the agnostic thinker, they went on to him and said that, there is a great man now here who is here to end and help us with removal of all suffering and promise a path of enlightenment. So would you like to come with us? And Sanjay in that phrase denies this. And this is a quotation, I mean, that's an interpretation of the wording that I've given. So when Sanjay was asked by his disciples that you would like to, what all can we learn from you? Like, is there anything else that we can learn from you, from all that you have taught us or while we were with you? So that's how it's interpreted. It said that after spending long years seeking the path, I do not claim whether the fruit of the path, marg phal, exists or not. I am not the man you need. I say that I do not claim anything. I do not claim to have found nothing. So there is no claim to have found anything. There's no claim to have found nothing. So that's how it is expressed here. Well, the interpretation varies from text to text, but this is a generally acceptable explanation or interpretation by Nagarjuna. So, so there is an interesting part to Sanjay, because in my dissertation, though I was working on the agnostic thinkers at that time, but four of them that are mentioned, and they have subtle differences, not major differences, but subtle differences among them. And the fourth one is of the Sanjay, whom I've majorly worked upon. So in the first school did suspend judgments, just like the method that I have explained, but they did it for a purpose. So the first school did this escapism or agnostic approach, took their apnotic approach to avoid intellectual debates and friction that they may create, as ideological beliefs are mostly irreconcilable due to privation of knowledge. So the first school believed that we should not take positions and always follow this method of amaravikhepika, that is a suspension of judgment, because it avoids intellectual debates and frictions, and most beliefs that we carry are because of our privation of knowledge. So nobody knows completely everything, so we can avoid that and we can take this position. The second school avoided holding any view, because what one believes today may be disbelieved in future. So that may lead you to be guilty about your past. So better to entertain the views externally without accepting or rejecting it. So you may have your beliefs and you can keep them, but don't accept or reject them, because you may change your beliefs with time. So, and that may lead you to guilt, because if you're really enforcing them today, you may realize that you shouldn't have done that. So, and the third school wanted to do, similar to somewhat Jain thought, that we can avoid violence and suffering if we don't take positions, because with positions we lead to clash, othering, and we can have, it brings ego, because when we are certain, we believe we are absolutely, the others are wrong, and so on and so forth. So they believe that it's good to not take positions and avoid, because it eventually lead to non-violence. And the fourth school, of course, was of Sanjay, who suspended judgments even on the purpose of suspension of judgment. So perhaps, well, we think this was because to state a purpose is also somewhere accept some judgment, which eventually you must suspend again. So when he was asked why you were suspending judgments, he again suspended judgments on the very fact that he was suspending judgments. So this school is generally referred to as the most stupid school out of all the listed schools, heretical schools in the Buddhist literature. So there are some 64 schools mentioned of various beliefs, as I told you, eternalism, annihilationalism and all that. But this school out of all the 64th is considered the stupidest and the dumbest school. But apparently modern scholars have written, particularly like scholars like Mathilal, Jayathilak, who started writing about this school a bit in 20th century, they said there must have been something very significant about this school, otherwise why it was written and mentioned so much in these scriptures. Even it's scanty, but they have been consistently been mentioned. So if it was that stupid and they had no, really any significance, why it was mentioned so many times. So, coming to now to the various questions that were asked to Sanjay, among various, references that we find across Pali and, Sanskrit Buddhist texts, these were the questions that were asked to him, and he basically avoided taking any position of them. So the first one was, of course, on this world and life. So is this world real, and are we really living, or this is really there, we are really living beings? No response to that question. The second one was on the afterlife. If there is a world beyond this life, there is no world beyond this life, there is both world and no world beyond this life, there is neither a world nor a world beyond this life. No response. Then questions on rebirth. Are there beings spontaneously reborn? Are there no beings that are spontaneously reborn? So the rebirth debate, whether we are reborn or not, whether we are both or whether neither. So no response to that. So they are not nihilists, if you see, because they are even denying, I mean, they are suspending judgments on the fourth position as well, neither nor. Questions on karma, which is what you shall, so shall you reap. So what you do comes back to you. Well, no response again. As the fruits of good and bad action, no fruit. Both fruit and no fruit of result of good and bad action, neither fruit or result, nor no fruit or result of good and bad action. No response. Similarly, another somewhere he's asked a question on mortality and immortality of the liberated one. So of course, does the liberated one exist after death? Does the liberated one does not exist after death? And so on, no response. And the next is on fruits of becoming an ascetic. What's the fruit of becoming a monk? No response again. Are there fruits of contemplative life visible then, here and now? I don't want to say anything. Like, that's what he'll keep responding. So that's how he kept on doing it for. So if there are no fruits of this, so shouldn't we become? We shouldn't become monks? No response. Then finally, on the claim of being the awakened one. So in some scriptures, he was asked that whether you are the awakened one, you are the very enlightened one, you really believe that you have, excelled in some way. Of course, then again, there is no response. And there is a response, I'm sorry, but there is no position taken. Then question on telos, purpose, goal, or end. So if there is a purpose or reason behind anything, no purpose or reason behind anything, there is no, statements made in either of it. So if you see, there are a lot of... So there is a considerable amount of discussion that has been done, though in not a great detail, but yes, you find that there are a lot of questions which are not responded by to him in a propositional manner. And it seems to us, therefore, that yes, there is a consistency in the way this thinker has been interpreted. Then in the Bodha text, these three positions have been given categorically to Sanjay and to Agyanuvadins, or these agnostic thinkers. One is the Merivikhepika, which I told you, the equivocators. So one who constantly equivocates and escapes making any affirmative, negative, both on either claim, like a slippery fish, irregulars, which I already told you. Then the other is Aviruddhaka. These are non-rival thinker or person, since Sanjay neither claims to accept any position nor claims to deny any position, and only questions about the claims made by others. He's not seen as a rival thinker, as against those who denied other philosophical positions. So he was not really seen by the Buddhists as a proper real rival, because he was not really denying any position. He was only questioning the positions, and he did not even affirm nor deny any position. So that's how he was referred to as. Then finally, Vaitandik. Vaitandik basically is a form of a debate expressed in Indian philosophical tradition, where a person is debating with a person but does not establish his position. So you're critiquing somebody in a debate, but you don't establish your own position. So that's what is a Vaitandik position, and he's also referred to as that. That is because normally in a debate, which is a vad in Sanskrit, you both people who are debating have positions, and they then debate about it and finally try to resolve it. But here, in this kind of a debate, one has a position and the other doesn't. So many people, especially one of the schools in Indian philosophy, in India, I think it's a very unfair debate. So anyway, so moving on to the last part of my talk, which is basically a reflection on all other kinds of views that were possible. So I discussed with you two kinds of things. One was the interpretation by the Buddha Ghosh, which I worked upon to see how he was escaping all positions. The second way through was the questions that he was suspending, which were asked to him. Based on that, I tried to imagine all the metapositions in philosophy that could be taken. And I found that his position, Sanjay's position, is falling out of all of them. So if you see clearly, the first position, as I referred, was dogmatic position. Don't take the word dogmatic in a negative way. It simply means somebody who asserts. So dogmatic position is where you believe that some views are true and some views are false. So for example, if you believe in eternal soul, then of course you would hold that soul is not eternal to be false. So there are certain philosophical, this is the most common position in philosophy, in metaphysical position, where we believe certain propositions and positions to be true and certain positions to be false. So if I'm a believer of God, I'll hold that position to be true, but I'll deny the position of, atheism. So that's the first position. The second position is of a skeptic or a nihilistic position, existentially or epistemologically taken. So these people are the ones who believe everything is false and this is true. So there are certain philosophers who believe that everything is false, but this claim that everything is false is true. That's not, again, a position Sanjay takes. The third is the emptiness position, the shunyata, which is everything is not neither true nor false. It is empty or void. There is at least some response by Madhyamika school of Buddhist philosophy, which holds that there is something limitedly, at least, in response, they say that if you try to look for essences, you wouldn't find anything. So the reality is empty or void. Now, this kind of affirmative response is also not given by Sanjay. Then the fourth position is of the sophist or the trivialist or the egalitarians, who believe that everything is true and nothing is false. So, all judgments are true. Some people may claim to hold that everything is true, which of course eventually takes away the whole distinction between truth and falsity, but nonetheless they hold that. That's not Sanjay's position either. Then we have the Kenya position, which is in the Kayan Upanishad, it's a text in Indian philosophy, Kayan Upanishad, which maintains that if you hold something to be true in language, you don't know the truth. And if you don't hold something to be true, you know the truth. So they believe, that the truth is actually something which shouldn't be stated. If you're stating that you know something, you don't know the truth. So that's not position of Sanjay either. Then the agnostic position is usually the position given where one say that I cannot know if anything is true or false, which are affirmative agnostics because they do admit that we do not know. And on the other hand, we have evasive ones which believe that we don't want to claim anything, but we do it for the purpose. Okay. Then finally, we have the position of silence. There are people who never utter anything absolutely about anything. They may have understood anything, but they don't utter that. That's not also there because Sanjay explicitly gives responses to all the questions. So there is clearly a verbal, response there. And finally, the position of contradiction, something is true and is false simultaneously. That's also is not there. So if you see, he's actually falling out of most positions that we can conceive in any metaphysical literature, be in any religion or in any philosophy. Then we come to, so what did I do was, since he puts all questions and propositions into tetralemma, I have put all these listed positions that I just discussed into a tetralemma here. And if you see, you can see that actually in the first position, which is affirmative position, you can put sophists or the trivialists, which basically hold only truths and no falsity. Then in the negation position, skeptics and radicalists can be there. I missed radicalists, I'm so sorry. So radicalists were the ones who believed everything is false and this is also false. So very few thinkers like Greek philosophers like Arcesilaus, I think if we believe the ascription to him, believe that he critiques Socrates that, all I know is that I know nothing. You should say I know nothing and I'm not even sure if I know nothing. So, you should actually claim everything to be false and you should claim that this is also false. That's more consistent position of falsity than to admit truth about falsity. So the radicalist position was of that everything is false and this statement uttered is also false. So kind of a paradox, but that's what they believed in. So I'm sorry. So I put dogmatics and, radicalists in the negative because only falsity is falsity. Skeptics are there. Then if you see the third one, which is contradiction, I put the dogmatics because they believe something partly to be true and partly to be false. Contradiction because they do accept simultaneous existence of both truth and falsity. And the Kenyans, if they, of course, they interplay with that. If you hold something to be true, it's false. And if you hold something to be false, then it's true. So I put that into third. And the fourth one is affirmative agnostics, who affirm that we cannot know, either now or later. So, and finally, beyond that, I have put the affirmations, responses of the evasive agnostics, who do say we cannot know, like Sanjay, but they do admit the reason or the purpose for why they were saying it. And finally, the Shunyata position, which also admit that, you know, we do at least have an affirmative response of Shunya, that it's void. The void is not really a category, but they do, in a verbal form, it's an affirmative response. Then finally, I put Sanjay's position. So I've shown that he is going beyond all possible positions, technically, that could be conceived. Moving on, if you see, this is just a flow chart to make you show that all positions in philosophy, whether you accept any truth or not, if you deny one, falls into the other. So if you see all views are true, none are false, there could be two options from this. So if you see the top list, all views are true, none are false, then if you deny it, then you end up with anti-egalitarian position. If you accept it, then it's fine. So if you deny it, then there are two possibilities. Either some views are true or some views are false, or all views are false and none are true. So if you again, you know, accept it, it's fine. But if you deny it, it goes back to the previous one, or it falls to the other. So basically, all positions of truth in some way are connected to each other. But position of Sanjay completely stands out from them. So if you affirm or deny, it leads to another. It falls by default to another. But in Sanjay, it completely is standing out. It stands out completely from all others. So, you know, so of course, there is no purpose mentioned. So one would ask why one would do this philosophy. So in my thesis, what I tried to work on was that I can't, of course, say that Sanjay had a purpose, because by seeing literally as interpreted by the Buddhists, he's not having a purpose to suspend judgments, but definitely I thought of what could perhaps be the possible significance of doing suspension of judgment. So I felt that there were certain approaches that this method could lead to, because this is not just a mere verbal jugglery or mere sophism where he was just playing tricks with people. I believed he was genuinely trying to indirectly suggest something. And I felt that, you know, he may have kind of expressed certain indirect ways. Firstly, of course, he did not think that a teacher could really tell you what is the way, because maybe that's some sort of an influence that you can get from other, and it may take away your novelty and your own original understanding. So that kind of a teacher would be really making you really free to think the way you want to and have your own path to reality. Other than that, of course, I've listed down these things, like you can have a psychological approach to the suspension of judgment technique. It's beneficial in terms of getting freedom, mental freedom, equanimity, tranquility, no conflicting ideas. And you can have an egalitarian approach. That means you can have a evaluation of all sorts of ideas without being biased or having siding with any view. The third is explorations, of course, are much better possible when we don't have positions to hold on to. The fourth is the skeptical. So we are very quick in judging things to be true, false, right, wrong, good, bad. We are always, you know, we can entertain many beliefs without holding any, and we are not ready to just get into any, you know, ways to believe anything, neither through faith, revelation. We believe maybe, but we don't, we still hold them and continue our exploration. The last is the logical approach, which is basically saving these kinds of approach saves you from the fallacies of faulty generalizations, you know, and so you can see these as the significance. So just to, you know, that's all I wanted to say today. And so I just want to conclude that there was one thinker, very lesser known, existing somewhere, you know, whom I have tried to work upon, who was very different, who did not get into this whole, you know, debate about whether there is anything true or not, and if it is, what it is. He had a very unique method where all other heretical teachers were getting involved into these debates, what could be the reality, or they were denying reality. He is totally, I thought, in philosophical sense, unique and very different. And I missed this slide. This is basically the textual references that I found across scriptures. This may not be interest to all of you, but some of you maybe who are interested. So I found his references scattered in the original sources, from Pali to Tibetan to Sanskrit to Chinese. So it was very difficult for me to really see one text and read about him, because in each of these sources and these scriptures, I found tits and bits of his philosophy across there. So I stop with that. I hope it makes sense to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Anish. I think, of course, after a talk like that, it's somewhat disingenuous to have a discussion with an exchange of views and all the rivalries and lack of friendliness that involves. But rather than all the suspending judgment right now, I'm going to tea. I think we'll have a discussion first. I'm not going to do much tea. Alex, do you want to start us? Or do you want to do?
Thank you very much.
Yes.
I had a question about slide number 10.
All right. What is that?
Illocutionary.
Okay, sure, sure.
Avoiding contradiction.
Yes.
Yeah, so I can see that's one successful way of avoiding contradiction. And I just wanted to say that there is another way of avoiding contradiction. Maybe it's not relevant to interpreting Sanjay, but... something I saw in secondary literature on Madhyamaka,
mm-hmm.
where if the contradiction is between saying this is true and this is false, it looks contradictory, how do you avoid the contradiction? Well, one thing is to say that being true and being false don't exhaust all of the possibilities. They're not collectively exhaustive. They don't. Combination of those two still leaves actually another option. So to say that something is true or something is false then becomes a bit like saying something is red or it's blue. There's still some other possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, like, it's basically a way which we think. I mean, the other way around is because we only believe in two-value logic, but if we don't believe in just two-value logic, we would definitely have the third possibility. I think in a way, indirectly, it goes in alignment with what you're saying, because Sanjay being suspending judgments on this is somewhere, you know, if you see, is leaving a way towards this argument of, saving us from the fallacy of argument ad ignorantium, which basically says that if something is not proved to be true, that doesn't mean it is false. And if something is not proved to be false, it doesn't mean it's true. So clearly, one denial of one doesn't implicitly implies the opposite. There could be something in between as well. So I agree with that point completely. And you're right here stating that completely. Yeah, thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much for the talk. And then I'd like to ask a question about the questions that appeared on the slides 15, 16, 17, and 18. So, in some suttas, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha leaves questions of similar nature undeclared.
Yes.
And they are posed to him. Exactly in this, I think, Chattopadhyay
yes.
format.
Yes.
So the question is, why is he using the same framework? Is there any influence of Sanjaya sinking on him? And if he uses a different form, like what are the differences in his suspension of judgment and his reluctance of answering those questions?
Yeah, so to answer your first question, if you see, this technique of listing questions down in fourfold manner and then having a sort of response or no response is not only unique to Buddhism, as you saw, it was also there in Sanjay and Agyan thinkers. It's also found in Jain. It's a thing that we find across, like, for example, in Buddha, responded with his noble silence, these questions. Sanjay did respond with some sort of, verbal utterances. If you see Jainism, they responded these questions with maybe, because they wanted possibilities to exist. So every for Jain's response to these questions is that, okay, if you ask there is a life, they will say maybe. If there is no life, maybe. So they made everything, you know, asyad. So that kind of a tradition was there existing at that time, that these schools were apparently trying to question maybe, as interpreted by some scholars, the dogmatic and the you know, the assertive positions that existed, who were vehemently, categorically answering these questions. Now, coming about to the second question, which says that whether they were influenced, well, that's a topic of research, because of course Buddhists never, I think, as far as I have read the Buddhist scriptures, they never mentioned that they borrowed or Buddha borrowed anything from Sanjay, although in some few Mahayana scriptures, they do say that Sanjay was a precursor to Buddhist thought in a positive light, but nowhere it says that he influenced Buddha in any manner. So we don't know, but of course, independently, we can do research and see if perhaps there was something that Buddha did get influence from Sanjay, because Sanjay is regarded usually as a senior contemporary to them, all of them, Mahavir and Buddha. So it could have been that maybe Buddha did find a positive or a more, you know, meaningful, supposedly meaningful responses to that, because he did give a direction from his silence. Like, but in here, there is no direction. There is no, what do you call it? There is no initiation that you can see. Similarly, Jains also claim that they bettered philosophy of Ajnanavadins, because where they were saying, I do not think, we are at least saying, maybe this is, maybe that. So we are giving more possibilities and we are giving you a direction. So we can work on that. But you're right. I mean, there's no final answer to this, but that's a very good topic to work upon, to see if there was some sort of influence or betterment approach that these schools took from Sanjay. But Jains clearly claim that we, Sanjay, who was making their disciples lost, we gave them the direction. So where he was saying, I do not say anything, we are saying, okay, this is a possibility, that is a possibility. So we were giving you a positive hope towards that. And Buddhism also do give it, because there is a whole significance of the silence of Buddha to those 14 unanswerable questions, which is basically, you know, the path towards enlightenment and removal of suffering. So, yeah.
This is a related question.
Yes.
So some aspects of this seem similar to Buddhist.
Absolutely.
It is one way in which they're dissimilar, is that in the Buddhist case, it's just certain questions, like about the times after death, and the beginnings of the universe and stuff like that. Whereas in Sanjay's case, it's for all questions. Is that sort of one of the key differences?
Well, you know, honestly speaking, the list of questions that I have shown you are not there in any book. They have never been listed. It has been largely collected by me from original and some secondary sources. I, honestly speaking, pardon my ignorance, but I do not know how many questions did Buddha suspend, or I mean, was silenced to. I think they generally list 14. So I don't know if that is exhaustive. I don't know even this if this is exhaustive. But definitely there is a lot of overlapping that we see among the questions. What I understood from this was, which I can state with some confidence, is that definitely there was a certain movement and a certain view or a flow of ways of dealing thing that was going on that time, and these thinkers were a part of that, because no philosophy works in isolation. All philosophies work in interaction with other philosophical thoughts and with social influences and economical influences existing at the time. So there are so much of parallels that we see between Jain, Buddhist and Ajnan thinkers that I believe it's difficult to say who was really completing the list, really, I don't know. But I think I would say that it's good to perhaps collect all of them together. from the Jain, from the Buddhist, and from the agnostic, and maybe others as well, to see what was the entire corpus of literature which was debated on. I don't know if I answered your question, really. I try to.
That's interesting. Could I just have a short thought?
Yeah.
If you had to say, why is it that other schools thought so badly about this school and called them this school?
I'm sorry, if, why?
Why were they considered a stupid school?
Oh, okay, because they did not give any purpose for stating their method. So that's what we imagine, because in the scriptures it's written this is the fourth school, and like, say for example, one of the kings went to Sanjay and he said, he asked, what is the fruit of becoming a monk? I'm a king, maybe I would like to become a monk. Now all of them gave some response and different responses to why one should become, and sometimes the answers were similar. Sanjay did not. So when he went to Buddha and he said that there is some guy Sanjay, some man Sanjay, who did not even answer me. So then the discussion was like, oh, he's the stupidest. So, you know, so we assume that, I mean, that's how we infer that it, because he did not state a purpose, because usually every philosopher states purpose for what they're trying to say. Even if they're nihilistic, if you're a skeptic, you have purposes to some sort of significance. But here, literally, there doesn't come. I think the indirect point that is more important is to see, I think, in one way, is that this kind of is the beautiful thing that about Sanjay, is that he was very consistent with this method. And I think somewhere the truth that he wanted to, I don't know if it's truth, but the epistemic method that he developed, for him that was more important than trying to perhaps, you know, getting into some sort of explicit declaration about how you can have a good life. I think he really wanted that to be indirect, as I understand, because what else could the method mean otherwise? So, where every other thinker was trying to answer and give a direction to their disciple, questioning to some extent to their autonomy, I think here in this school, you cannot have an organization, you cannot have an initiation. So, as free is the teacher, as free is the student. I mean, disciple. So, but yeah, they're considered, of course, dumb and stupid by people who believe that stating an explicit, you know, goal and benefit to some doing something is important. In fact, they're all fighting for that, trying to show that our method is better. You follow it, and we'll promise you a great, you know, a verdict or result. That was the debate. Because if you see Pyrrho, with Pyrrho this happened, the Greek philosopher Pyrrho, who also advocated the philosophy of suspension of judgment, epoche. But when he advocated it, he had a debate about what is the best form of life. So with is it eudaimonia or is it, you know, ataraxia, whether it is Epicureans who are giving. So then the skeptic schools got into that debate. That no, our ways of suggestion, the better life is better than yours. And the whole purpose of suspending of judgments was defeated. So I believe Sanjay avoided that. Because if you would have answered something, you would have got into the debate, like all others did, got into that debate. So I don't know, maybe that answers your question. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, of course, I mean, one thing I'm
yes.
interested in is, of course, the relation of all of that material to
Madhyamaka,
especially as
oh, yeah.
many of the epithets that are, you know, delivered against Sanjay are also delivered against the Madhyamakas, like Vaidantika, for example,
yes.
right, so having an opposition.
Yes.
So, now, are these interesting questions to see, you know, where exactly the difference is, and perhaps one thing to think about is that the reference you gave to Shariputra being a disciple of Sanjaya before he became a disciple of Buddha, so obviously he wasn't quite satisfied with what he learned there, otherwise he would have gone to a different teacher. And if we look at the traditional story of how Shariputra became an arahat, is when he was already, of course, fairly advanced practitioner at the time, when he met the Buddha, and the Buddha taught him one verse, and then Shariputra became enlightened and became an arahat. And so that one verse was the Yidhapa verse, Yidhapa, which is basically the short formulation of Pratitya-samyutta, independent origination, right? Which is also the one thing that Nagarjuna singles out in the Mangala Shloka to the Karikas of what the Buddha taught, the root of the auspicious is Pratitya-samyutta, it's independent origination. So perhaps it's perhaps we should say the Madhyamaka is Sanjaya plus dependent origination.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just like Jacob's point that he says, okay, well, they don't suspend judgment on everything, and especially the Madhyamakas wouldn't suspend judgment on the statement that Pratitya-samyutta is at least conventionally true, right? So you do have a clear distinction there. I think you pointed that out in one of your final slides when you talked about the Shunya position, right? Where you say that they make at least some assertions at the level of conventional reality, whereas Sanjaya certainly does not, and is therefore definitely very consistent with what he's doing.
So yeah, at the face of it, it sounds absurd because, you know, what's the point of you reading you or studying you or becoming your disciple of you? You know, one would ask him. But I think there's clearly an indirect answer, and I think what is indirect would never be made direct, you know, so that's how it is. But I think what is interesting is that there were people like that in the history of thought who existed, who were kind of not the way others were, and this is not in just terms of differing in thought, but the very foundations of the way you do philosophy, if at all you admit a broader understanding or broader definition, if you accept broader definition of philosophy, they would fall into these newer categories. So I just thought I mean, personally, because I like this thinker and I personally think in this manner a bit, of course, because you choose what you generally like, so you know, so I thought I can perhaps develop more about it. I started reading about him personally, but then slowly and slowly I found that there's so much to dig out, and then I finally worked on him. So I would really thank you, Professor Westerhoff. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here, to you know, giving me this chance to come all the way here to give a talk on this, because I think each question that you all asked is very important and interesting, and I think that will help me with my research and your comments and your feedback. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for coming and speaking to us today. I think this might probably be a good time not to suspend the discussion, but to move the discussion earlier.
Yes.
Right? And so let's once again thank our speaker for the wonderful talk.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So let's see that we can switch this off now. I think first of all this, and then stop. First this, and then...
Yeah.
Okay. Great. And then I'll give this back to Jacob, and then let's move over to two. Okay, Jacob, so I pressed this, and then I pressed stop.
Great.
Was that right? So I think
so.
Yeah. I'm still
recording, so I'll press stop.
Well,